Blog Talk Radio.
I'm terribly sorry, sir, but your credit card
has
been declined.
Your unemployment benefits ran out 2 weeks
what
ago.
What do you mean I'm overdrawn?
2 weeks ago.
I still have checks left. Checks
2 weeks
left.
Ago.
Too much month left over at the end of the money? Bad credit holding you back? Want to become a real estate investor but haven't won the lottery? Learn how to fix your credit. Get out of debt and build true financial independence with real estate in 2 hours a week. Tune in to Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio. She'll show you how, without winning the lottery or working 10 jobs. And here's your host, Heather Wagenhall.
Greetings and salutations, everyone. Welcome to the broadcast. You are listening to Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio, and this Saturday, February 20th, like every Saturday at 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, and every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, we broadcast the Unlock Your Wealth radio program and talk about crisis management and financial wellness tools designed to help everyone, man, woman, and child alike, manage their finances and attitudes for the single purpose of achieving financial independence. And this week is unlike any other. Well, all right, so maybe it's like every other, because we always have a great show. I can't say that I've ever really been disappointed in the people that drop by to participate in the show or the news and events that are going on to be able to say that I haven't had a satisfactory episode. So today, like every other week, we have an incredible show planned for you today. We have some incredible minutes on your money, a commercial real estate update, 8 reasons for investors to worry, and 5 things that kill home insurance. Also, we've got coming up on Monday the Credit Card Act, or the CARD Act, C-A-R-D Act, is going into effect in its final phase. How is that going to affect you and the future of plastic? There are 5 credit trends I thought are very interesting and wanted to share with you. In addition to that, on today's program, we have every week our Unlock Your Wealth protege, famous NASCAR race car driver Stephen Light, will be joining us for the broadcast, and we're going to follow him along his financial coaching path while we check in and see what he's up to. And then our Investor's Edge guest this hour is going to be Paul Richards, and he runs the Institute for Consumer Financial Education, and he's going to join us again. He's been a past guest on our show, and he's just a wealth of information and resource when it comes to managing your money, so we're going to look forward to talking with him in a bit. As always, we have our regularly scheduled segments, our Millionaire Minute, It's On Your Money, from the illustrious, ever-popular Karen Gurm, our segment host, show producer, and e-zine publisher. So, have you guys figured out that the e-zine is where to go to get everything you need to know about news, financing, real estate information, tips and tricks to help you create financial independence for you and your family? Well, look no further. Let me tell you how to be a part of the weekly e-zine. Simply, if you're listening from our Blog Talk Radio's show page, just scroll down to the bottom of the page, and there you will find a box that you can just drop your email address into and hit subscribe me, and voila! You will be a part of the action. If you're podcasting and not listening from the show page live, then you can surf over to our website, www.unlockyourwealth.com, and sign up for your weekly copy of the electronic magazine, in addition to all the news, tips, tricks, and information that we have available. We also have our trivia question for the week. And our trivia question, if the correct answerer, can win fabulous prizes like merchandise from the Unlock Your Wealth radio store. You can win our Best of Season 1 and Season 2 interviews. You can win autographed books from our previous show guests. Or you could opt for financial coaching. Or maybe you might need a credit report review from a certified credit report reviewer. All these things, including Identity Theft Shield protection, available for you simply by subscribing to the e-zine and being the first to answer. And the value is the e-zine comes out before the broadcast. So if you are thinking you want to be a winner, all of our questions are taken from our previous show guests. So how fabulously simple is that? So if you just look up the trivia question, it's so simple. If you didn't listen to the last broadcast, it's so easy. Read the question and go back and give it a listen, and now you know what you're looking for. So you'll have the answer to win fabulous prizes. How about some minutes on your money, shall we? From the basics, five things that kill home insurance. This is by Peter Lewis and MSN Money. We have all heard of people who can't get insurance because of their age or their health. Here are conditions that could make it hard to buy coverage for the average homeowner. Insurance broker Doug Akiyashi once walked into a backyard in Seattle to take some photos of a potential client's house. Suddenly, this dog appeared out of nowhere. He said it was a lab and it was in attack mode. And I climbed that wall as fast as you can imagine. Akiyoshi, based in Mercer Island, Washington, said he later phoned the owners and told them, you know, you've got a problem here. Does that dog have a biting habit? Just what people need. And they answered, well, that was one of the reasons why we got dropped by our other carrier, Akiyoshi recounted. He informed them that the dog was why he, too, would be declining coverage. Homeowners often learn the hard way that standard insurance policies don't cover natural disasters such as floods and earthquakes, but less dramatic and less well-known problems can put even a standard policy out of reach. And this is one example. Dog bites account for one-third of homeowners' liability claims, costing insurers $387 million in 2008 alone. As a result, agencies have all but blacklisted homeowners with pit bulls, Rottweilers, or other dogs included on the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's list of deadly breeds. But a dog of any breed with a history of biting, such as the dog belonging to Akiyoshi's would-be clients, is likely to send insurers running as well. So, knob and tube wiring. You got some? It might be time to rewire. That was the main method of electrical wiring for the 1880s through 1930s, lasting even into the 1950s. Back then, a single outlet per room was common, and the average household's few appliances didn't collectively suck much power. What concerns insurance is the strain that today's power-hungry appliances places on older wiring. Knob and tube wiring typically doesn't have a ground, and you're not supposed to use modern three-hole outlets unless the ground is functional. So fuse boxes, often accompanied with older wiring, also pose another problem as a safety feature. They have thin slivers of metal designed to blow when too much electricity courses through them, shutting off power. But homeowners occasionally try to beat the system and keep the electricity flowing by sticking pennies, which are much thicker, into the fuse socket. Doing so makes the wiring inside a house's walls hot, so hot that the house could catch on fire. Good luck convincing an insurance agent that you would never try this. Some regular carriers will cover you without making you tear out all of your knob and tube wiring, and they can live with it running between a wall and a switch and overhead lights, assuming you're otherwise rewired with ground outlets for power-hungry appliances such as microwaves, TVs, and hair dryers. But the bad news is paying for those upgrades plus a new circuit breaker costs thousands of dollars, so affordable insurance doesn't necessarily come cheap. I'm spilling my water here. So what else do you need to know? Wow, that was cold. Past claims on a drop policy can doom you. Let's say you've been living in a condo when you get a job across the country. Somewhere you can afford to buy a house. You cancel your condo homeowner's policy and move into an apartment until you can occupy your single-family residence. But 18 months ago, while still in the condo, you filed a water damage claim under your homeowner's insurance policy, a claim easily accessible to all carriers through a shared database. You can pretty much queue up game over. Filing any claim can be the kiss of death when your policy comes up for renewal, but you're even more likely to be a dead duck if you let your insurance lapse. That's because carriers hold new clients to even tougher standards, and by letting your policy lapse, that's what you've become. A State Farm agent explained the actuarial reasoning in this way. Data shows that 70% of customers never have a loss. Of the remainder, 18% file only one claim, leaving 12% who ever file two or more. So underwriters wield a generally unyielding measuring stick. People who file claims do not fit into the same low-risk profile as people who don't. A carrier may show mercy to existing customers depending on the type and severity of the claim or how long they've been customers. But if you've been previously filing a claim and you let your insurance policy lapse before shopping for a new one, you're probably out of luck in the mainstream market too. Now, we are not family. Does your household consist of more than two unrelated people living under the same roof? If so, expect a thanks but no thanks response from most regular carriers when you go shopping for homeowners insurance. Insurance companies view such households as high-risk bohemian spaces and will therefore generally decline to cover you. Their thinking is the residents will be inconsistent about locking doors. Such living arrangements come perilously close to a boarding house with a greater chance of vandalism, stoves getting left on, and more foot traffic than a more traditional household. So, partay Friday night or any night in Le Animal House is what your insurance agent is thinking. Pride of ownership or lack thereof. It's one thing to be a slob around the house, and a man's home is his castle, right? But when slovenliness spills outside, broken down appliances on the lawn, unregistered clunkers in the driveway, ensuring your castle could prove to be impossible. Insurers like to see evidence that you're maintaining your property. From an insurance agent's point of view, signs of trouble that don't reflect well on you raise liability issues and will likely rule out your chances for standard coverage. Those items include a moss-covered roof, a lack of gutters or downspouts, peeling paint, buckled sidewalks or driveways caused by tree roots, seriously overgrown yard, non-working unregistered vehicles parked in the driveway or in the front of the house. You can deal with some of the disrepair issues listed above by yourself, or you can hire a handyman or contractor to do it. In some cases, including electrical work, may be necessary for you to obtain permits in order to do so. So in addition to making your home insurable through regular channels, the fixes will make it more valuable when you sell. Now, if all else fails, if repairs aren't on your horizon, your record is riddled with past claims, or you don't want to get rid of your dog or your roommates, you can try the so-called higher-risk residual market. Industry-subsidized programs known as FAIR plans, F-A-I-R, were set up by many states in the late 1960s after riots made it difficult for some people to obtain homeowners insurance. More information is available through the Property Insurance Plan Service Office, or PIPSO, a not-for-profit corporation based in Massachusetts. Wow, am I parched today? Uh, PIPSO President Ron Casuso says that it is not possible to make an apples-to-apples comparison between standard and fair plan premiums because of the relatively limited coverage under many fair plans and because financial data for those are compiled differently. But he acknowledges that the residual market price policies generally cost more and provide less coverage. But for people who have no choice but to pay sky-high premiums, another option for homeowners insurance to deal with companies that offer so-called excess or surplus lines. However, that means doing business with unregulated carriers that can basically charge as much as they want. So, take care of your stuff, man, and hopefully you won't have to worry about those five things. So, I mentioned that the commercial real estate industry is rebounding. And according to David Ellis, a staff writer for CNN.com, luckily for banks, the commercial real estate time bomb just keeps on ticking. Industry observers have issued dire warnings for more than a year, suggesting that lenders are on a collision course with potentially billions of dollars worth of commercial real estate losses. But for all the gloomy talk about fallout, it has remained relatively well contained. Banks already have recognized about $50 billion in losses, or 60% of the estimated cumulative losses, according to real estate research firm Foresight Analytics. And despite a steep drop in the price of apartments, office buildings, and industrial properties nationwide over the past year, there have been some recent indicators to suggest that the market may have finally hit bottom. After 13 months of consecutive declines, overall commercial property values climbed 1%, according to the most recent monthly reading by Moody's Real Commercial Property Price Index. Even well-respected bankers have offered a glass-half-full outlook on the state of the commercial real estate market. According to J.P. Morgan Chase Chief Executive Officer Jamie Dimon, he says commercial real estate is a train wreck, but it's already happened. During a company-sponsored conference last month, he shared some words, but some commercial real estate industry experts have been quick to caution that the problems aren't over yet. High-profile purchases that were made at the height of the real estate bubble have started to implode left and right. Last month, owners of New York City's Stuyvesant Town and Peter Cooper apartment complexes went into default. Farther south, lenders that helped finance the Four Seasons Resort and Club just outside of Dallas are moving ever closer to foreclosing on that swanky 400-acre property. And with the nation's unemployment rate still hovering at 10% and consumer spending at sickly levels, it stands to reason that the borrowers that deal in retail stores and office building will feel even more squeezed before long. Businesses just aren't taking office space, and consumers aren't buying things at retail stores, says Mark Reedy, the executive director of Burnham Moore Center for Real Estate at the University of San Diego. That's a deadly prospect for the thousands of community and regional banks nationwide that hold roughly $860 billion in commercial mortgages and construction development loans. George Synovus Financial and Zions Bancorp of Utah and Buffalo, New York-based bank M&T are just a few banks whose loans portfolios are highly concentrated in commercial real estate, according to credit rating agency Standard & Poor's. By trying to gauge the scope of those problems has proven difficult, as banks have been slow to recognize the losses on many of these loans. Unfortunately, the consensus is that neither prices nor occupancy rates will improve anytime soon. Estimates published last November by the Urban Land Institute and PricewaterhouseCoopers suggest that commercial real estate vacancies will continue to increase in 2010, while prices could tumble further during the year. Prices could fall as low as their peak levels from 07. So if it was a peak in 07, that wouldn't be so bad, like, would it? Because that wasn't that long ago. And properties were kind of overvalued at that point. Matt Anderson says from Foresight Analytics, if that happens, it would only darken borrowers' hopes that banks will refi their outstanding loans. And some $1.4 trillion with a T is commercial real estate debt is expected to come due over the next 3 years. Matt says, when you combine that with property values decline, you have a big problem. So, how How about 8 reasons for investors to worry? My buddy Jim Juback writes in his journal, Juback's Journal, as economic volatility in the U.S. and abroad left you somewhat twitchy, that isn't necessarily a bad thing. The trick is figuring out how to best expend your anxiety. So Jim Juback writes, this is my fourth take in less than 6 months on how to worry. I wrote the first one in October when the Dow Industrial had poked its head above 10,000 for the first time in a year, and the S&P was just about to kiss 1,100. Now I'm writing on the topic just days after the Dow touched 10,000 again, but this time it's headed in the other direction. The Dow closed at 99.08 on February 8th. In October, the worry was that the stock market had gone up too far, too fast, and was ready for a fall. Now the worry is that the long-feared decline has finally arrived, and that it will be much worse than the correction that investors have been waiting for. At least that's the fear. So all history tells you something about how tough the past 4 or 5 months have been on investors who have been through 2 bear markets in less than 10 years and are justifiably inclined to jump at every bit of good news, good or bad. Jumping at every bit of news is actually not bad behavior. The lesson in the past decade is that investors can get easily too complacent. Remember the saying, you're not paranoid if they really are out to get you. I like that. So buy and holder beware. Juback just came back from an investment conference in Orlando, Florida, where he heard a number of speakers proclaim that the 60% rally off the March bottom proves that the buy and hold investing is alive and well. But frankly, he feels that all that remark proves is that the complacency is alive and well after 2 bear markets has left many buy and hold investors looking at a 0% for the decade on their returns. So being jumpier than a Chinatown cat during Lunar Chinese New Year celebrations isn't a bad thing, since the real world now is full of contradictory trends that seem to take control of the market for just a week or two at a time. All being jumpy proves that you are paying attention. What, me worry? That still leaves us with an all-important question. Is if some of this news is just noise and not worth acting on, and some is important in the real world and worth acting on, then how do we tell the difference? And what's and that's where the how to worry list of what the real world important stuff is to worry about and when it comes in. By listing the potential turning points in the stock market over the remainder of 2010, how to worry indicates what news might be worth acting on. Here is Jim's list, and his list is put together with a goal that tells you, one, what the chances are that something will go wrong, two, how bad might it be if it does go wrong, and three, when things might go wrong. So worry number one, the leaders of the European Union will fumble about issues, emptying promises to support Greece in its budget crisis before cobbling together a solution that makes bondholders just happy enough and removes the threat now hanging over European banks outside Greece that are holding Greek sovereign and bank debt. The most likely outcome is that it's clear to everyone exactly how reluctant the German government is to get into the guarantee business and dent the country's AAA reputation for fiscal conservative, and that's something that will turn into a boiling crisis from just a simmering problem. Worry number two, the next season of China's National People's Congress begins March 5th. If China is going to officially change monetary policy or shift more spending to domestic consumption, it's likely policy change will be announced as a result of this meeting. The big policy issues for China's stock market this year is all the concern of cheap money. March could see the government announce that it will raise the interest rates. This has pushed down stock prices in general and pushed down the share of prices of real estate developers and many industrial companies, especially hard. The other big policy question is whether the government will do something to toughen its now rather toothless system for setting lending targets for banks. That would also send China's stocks tumbling. Worry number three, near the end of April, investors will get the first official numbers on how fast the U.S. and Chinese economies grow in the first 3 months of the year. For the U.S., the worry is that the data will show slowing growth significantly from 5.7 recorded at the first estimate in the fourth quarter So everybody expects growth to slow as the recovery moves along and the effects of the February 2009 stimulus package wear off, but too big a drop will reignite fears that the recovery hasn't become self-sustaining and that the U.S. could tumble back to a recent recession. Officials in Beijing studied at the first quarter numbers to see whether they had stepped on the brakes too hard or too soft by restricting bank lending in January. Okay. So, gosh, I need better glasses. Can I just tell you that? Where were we? Are we done with worry number three? Worry number four. No, wait. Worry number three. Everybody expects growth to slow as the recovery moves along and the effects of the February 2009 stimulus package wear off, but too big a drop will reignite fears that the recovery hasn't been self-sustaining. A repeat of China's fourth quarter 10.7% growth would be a disappointment because it would almost certainly mean that the government would have to restrict the money supply, and the odds of an interest rate increase would go up and stocks would go down. A number too far below 10.7 would indicate that the government has overreacted and signal a likely return to looser money. Investors, economists, and government officials will all be looking at March data such as February jobs numbers that the U.S. reports for the first week of March for clues on how the GDP growth will go. Worry number four, by the time the Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee meets in the last week of April, its members will know what the GDP numbers say about the first quarter, even if the public doesn't. And the April 28th second day policy statement might then include language that could indicate an interest rate increase sooner rather than later. The next meeting is on June 23rd and an even more likely candidate for a change in language. Any change won't be big. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke's testimony in the House Financial Services Committee last week made it clear that when the Fed finally does move, its first actions will be to raise the interest it pays to banks for money kept on deposit at the FRB. Maybe it'll nudge up short-term rates. Worry number five, central banks from India to Brazil are clearly thinking about raising interest rates this year. The Reserve Bank of India, for example, has done all the preparation for a rate increase. These increases play out differently in the U.S. than these increases, when they come, will be in economies that are growing so fast that inflation has become a real danger and not, as in the U.S., in an economy growing so slowly that a tiny increase could put the recovery at risk. Worry number six, the U.S. banking system still isn't out of the woods and, in fact, needs to raise new capital in the second half of 2010. Last month's mortgage foreclosure filings were up 15% from January of 2009, and bank seizures of homes could rise to a record 3 million in 2010, according to RealtyTrack. Studies show that once the value of a house falls below what the owner owes on a mortgage, the likelihood of foreclosure increases. More than 20% of U.S. homeowners had negative equity in the fourth quarter, according to RealtyTrack. Worry number seven, earnings growth could be less than now expected. I think this is a danger for more than the second half of 2010 than the first. Watch what happens as we start our year off. To see why, look at the pattern that earnings growth makes as we come off the bottom of the Great Recession. In the first quarter of 2010, projections called for S&P operating earnings of $17.12, up from $10.11 in the first quarter of 2009. That's 69% earnings growth year to year. Second quarter operating earnings are projected at $18.59, up $13.01 from a year earlier. That's 43% earnings growth. And third quarter 2010 are projected at $19.92, up from $15.78, and that's a 26% earnings growth. Last but not least, worry number eight is slowing economic growth remains a big worry in 2010. It's the one worry that, if turned into a reality, could make all the seven other worries in this list much, much worse, and it's the only one that could work to combine some of these discrete worries into much bigger crises all over again. And unfortunately, Jim doesn't discount the possibility that the world's developed economies, including the U.S., will lead a globe back into a painful slowdown at the end of 2010 into early 2011. The European Union could very well still be wallowing in crises. Then the effect of the U.S. stimulus package will be wearing off. And with the U.S. Senate seemingly unable to pass any legislation, the U.S. could go into the second half of 2010 without a budget for fiscal 2011, let alone a second jobs bill. So the U.K. could still be trying to gather to cobble some sort of government together after a dead heat election in May. But that, if that doesn't happen, the possibility is still very real. The developing markets look like a better bet for 2010 than the developing markets of Europe, Japan, and the U.S. Economic growth will be higher, debt overhangs are lower, and political problems seem more manageable. Developing economies won't grow like gangbusters if economies falter, but they will do better by investors, especially if they buy in on a dip at a reasonable valuation. So those are your eight reasons for investors to worry. And we have our Investor's Edge guest on the line. So it is now time to go and chat with this week's Investor's Edge guest all the way from the Institute of Consumer Financial Education. We have Paul Richards joining us, and he runs the Institute of Consumer Financial Education, which is dedicated to helping people of all ages improve their spending, increase their savings, and use credit more wisely. They also help to educate, motivate, and empower Americans through educational programs to put more of their discretionary dollars aside in investments for their future. They also help people refrain from overspending and credit card abuse, saddling themselves with consumer debt and high interest payments they often can't afford. They influence people to regularly save. They teach people how to keep more of the money they earn and do more with what they do keep. And they help employers everywhere make personal finance programs available to employees and their families as part of an employee assistant program and employee benefits package so as to lessen the outside and often financial distractions people bring with them to the workplace. So here we have it. Welcome to the broadcast, Paul, or I should say, welcome back to the broadcast.
Thank you. Delighted to be with you again, Heather.
I'm so excited for this new year and for the work that you do, and I wanted today's focus to kind of center around financial literacy in the sense that your organization really helps to proliferate financial literacy, not just by offering financial literacy programs to the general public, but you also do training programs and things that train the trainer. And I was wondering, because we have new listeners every day, and I know the old listeners will recognize your familiar voice from your last appearance, tell us what your organization does a little bit as an overview, and then we'll jump into a great big discussion.
Okay, I'd be happy to. The Institute of Consumer Financial Education was created back in 1982 by a man whose name was Lauren Dunton. If his name sounds familiar to any listeners, it is because he created and established the Certified Financial Planner designation. He founded the College for Financial Planning, and he basically established a new industry. As part of that work, he had in his business plan that consumers would need to be educated at some point in the future as to what this new financial planning industry was all about. And so the ICFE was on his drawing boards back in 1969 when he created the College for Financial Planning. The ICFE became a reality in 1982, and he dedicated the institute to helping people improve their spending practices, increase their savings accumulation, and use credit more wisely. And so that's our mission statement, and as part of that, As you pointed out, Heather, training and certifying professional educators, counselors, credit counselors, and others who work with consumers, and then also giving them some expertise in the area of consumer advocacy, as many times consumers just need a little help in getting their situation in order. And so the ICFE, now in our 28th year, is moving right along, and we're growing every year happily, and we're also happy to report that more and more individuals are getting control of their personal finances as a result of getting focused.
I really enjoy what the organization has to offer, and I'm so excited because much like Mr. Dutton, I know when I was in mortgages and I was trying to look for a way to help people understand the mortgage process a little bit better, and this was in the 90s, and you know, not everybody could qualify for a loan. They didn't understand mortgages at the time. And this is before the whole mortgage craze went in the early part of this century. And people just didn't understand, well, how do I even know if I qualify for a loan? And what happens if I don't qualify, or because there's an issue that needs to be resolved, whatever it may be, how do I do that? And then that's when I started saying, you know, here's an opportunity here for me to market myself, and that's what I did, by educating the consumer, and therefore I'd be able to get more people, like Mr. Dutton got people to invest with certified financial planners, I'd be able to get more people to do their mortgages with me. And that's what set me on my path to discovering that this was a bigger problem other than, you know, maybe they had too high a debt ratio or not enough savings. This was a financial literacy problem. People had no clue what they were doing. And that's what sent me along my mission and me going out into the workforce. And I remember in the mid, you know, about 2004, 2005, you know, the industry started to change and everybody wanted to over-leverage themselves. Everybody wanted to do 100% financing for their mortgages. And it was so funny because I was just kind of finishing up one of my first books on money management, and I thought, gosh, I'm not going to be able to sell this. I'm not going to have any value in the marketplace. I think I missed the boat. I missed the window. And then lo and behold, just like I had anticipated, as a result of all of that crazy lending, there was going to be a collapse. And now there's a bigger demand for financial literacy more than ever. At least that's what I'm seeing in the marketplace. And whether or not we can qualify it as a demand, I think at least there's a need for it. What are your thoughts about what's going on in our present economy?
Well, I'm glad you pointed that out, Heather, because I've noticed the same thing. There has been a tremendous uptick in the media talking about financial literacy, but more important, consumers in America have gotten way ahead of the federal government on the spending business, because this is what it all boils down to. And we certainly have seen an increase in interest here at the Institute, people wanting help with their spending, more people than ever going to our website and taking our interactive spending quizzes. We have one on Are You a Good Spender and another one on Are You an Overspender? And as long as we're talking about financial literacy, may I comment that the biggest number of overspenders in the United States is not people who spend more money than they have. It's people who pay too much for things. And so we're finding a growing awareness. We're very thankful for it, and we're helping people every day learn how to get a greater value for their dollar. And here's one way we say it, how to keep more of the money you make and do more with the money you keep.
I like that. You brought up an interesting twist on what people think about on overspending, and elaborate on the paying too much for things. How does one pay too much?
Well, largely by default, Heather, by not taking the time to do comparison spending, for example, or comparison shopping. That's the easiest way. And most consumers today, if they will take the time to comparison shop with at least five different retailers or merchants or whatever it is they're going for, they're going to be able to save money. Now, I'll give you a recent example. I needed some tires. I drive an MG, which is a foreign car, and it's almost 42 years old now, and I needed some new tires for that. And I shopped around, and after the fourth call, I was able to save $65 per tire just by doing some comparison shopping and spending. And people are engaged in these decisions every day as to what they're going to spend and how they're going to spend. And that leads me to another one of our little mantras here at the ICFE, and that is everyday spending decisions, especially credit-based ones, will have far more harm on your financial future than any investment decision you'll likely ever make. And so everyday spending decisions include how much money to spend on a new wardrobe, or how much money to spend on decorating a room in your home, whether or not you should borrow money for a new car, and if you do, how much money should you borrow, whether or not you should take your lunch today, or perhaps go out and eat with the rest of the folks at work, and on it goes. Everyday spending decisions are the ones that undo people's financial future.
Yeah, you know, that's a great point, because so many people focus on the catastrophic events that take them down. Oh, you know, I didn't replace my tires, systematically saving for them, knowing I need to replace them every so many thousand miles, and I drive X amount of miles a month, so I need to set aside, you know, $5 a month for tires. Because, you know, people think that it's like, oh, well, I just, you know, had two tires blow out in a matter of a week, and it cost me, you know, $300.
Mm-hmm.
And they think that that is where their hang-up is in the catastrophic event. And, well, I had to charge it, but had they been managing, and what I always say, watching what their daily dollars are doing, then those catastrophic events could be mitigated or eliminated totally, because you'd be saving for them.
That's right. One of the things that you may remember from your work through our personal instructor certification program is that when we are counseling and teaching people about doing their net worth, we call it the big picture and the close-up picture. And the big picture, of course, is one's net worth, you know, their assets and all they've been able to accumulate, subtracting any money they might owe on those assets. But the other point, the close-up picture, is how cash flow moves in and out of your life on a daily basis. And both pictures are very much connected. And here's the thing that we teach in our class that a lot of other people don't teach, and that is, let's say your net worth is $250,000. And you have been working full-time for the sake of our example, 10 years. And you have been earning $40,000 a year. And so over the 10-year time, you've earned almost $500,000. Your net worth is $250,000, and so you divide that by the number of years you've been working, and you can easily see that you've been able to accumulate and add to your net worth year after year after year. Well, contrast that with some individuals who have a zero net worth, who have worked for 10 years and earned $400,000 or $500,000 and have nothing to show for it. That's the message we need to get across to consumers today, Heather, and I know you're helping do that, and that is, pardon me, you have accumulated some wealth. How long did it take you to accumulate it, and how good a job are you doing? Are you able to hang on to more than 10% of your income every year is one good question to ask yourself. And for those individuals that don't have anything, they haven't been able to accumulate anything, this is your wake-up call. Get started today with a spending plan and start asking yourself the question, should I charge it? Can I afford it?
Those are great questions. And that was the one thing that I found that was so significant when I went through your instructor's program was to actually take a look at your net worth and divide it by the number of years you were working.
Yep.
And that, you know, I like to think outside of the box, but that never occurred to me how you can illustrate in concrete terms what you saved over.
That's right. And that particular fact escapes most financial planners, we have discovered. You talk to a financial planner, and they are so proficient and so knowledgeable about investments and mutual funds and all this and all that. But when you ask a financial planner a simple question, well, how can I improve my spending techniques? They're as much of a loss oftentimes as their client is. And so people, as a result of this financial crisis in America, have started to take a close look at their spending and their savings habits and saying, hey, something needs to change here. And happily, they're doing it. And that's what the ICFE is all about, and largely what your work is all about, is helping people learn how to make the changes and then motivating them to do it. Lauren Dunton, you know, never had a problem with financial planners selling an investment as long as it was disclosed properly ahead of time. He always had the opinion was, what good is a financial plan that sits in a consumer's drawer and is never implemented? And so products help individuals implement those financial plans. And as long as you know who's selling the product and who's making the commission, we don't have any problem with a financial planner motivating his clients to get involved in an investment and get that plan activated. And that's what needs to happen today. More people need to get started on their new spending plan.
They do. And you know, one of the things that made me love your program is I loathe and detest the word budgeting. And I know that so many people, well, because I think of it as like dieting, and it's something you go on to and off of. And it's all about loss and sacrifice, and you can only do that for so long before you binge. And just like in dieting, you can only, you know, avoid that chocolate cake that's calling your name for so long, and then instead of, you know, having it worked into your eating plan over a period of time where those calories would be negligible and your passion for chocolate cake satiated, no, what do? We forsake it for so long that when we finally get it, we pork out on it and we eat half the cake, where just, a bite here or there wouldn't have killed us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that people do that with budgeting. They don't analyze their actual expenditures or realize what it does take financially to provide for their family, and they cut out the wrong things. And then after a while, those things that they cut out, they can't live without, and then they just go nuts. And they blow it because of emotions and feeling entitlement and all of that good stuff. And, one of the things that I think is an important number for folks is when they do their big picture net worth statement and they look at how much money they have made, they should have at least 10% of that number, and because of the power of compounding, they should have way more than that number if they have been saving it.
Totally agree.
And it's scary to see how long some people have spent in the workforce, and instead of a positive net worth, they owe $60,000 in mostly unsecured debt, which blows me away that happens with people. And, you know, we had Larry Winget on this show, and he is the world's most irritational speaker, and he has written several books, but the one that applies to us is You're Broke Because You Want to Be, because of your ineffective decision-making. And, you know, I've come to the point, and I gave a presentation on empowerment some weeks ago, and I was trying to think of a great analogy and a way to talk about the difference between motivation and empowerment. And, you know, it's not hard to motivate people, you know, to want to be a millionaire, but how do we empower them to be financially independent? So that's a capability, and it's kind of like, you know, driving down the road in your car, and you know, you've deliberately taken out the jack, the spare tire, and the tire iron. And so when we have a flat, we have no idea how to fix it, and we don't have the tools without financial literacy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it is super important that we start retraining ourselves and refocusing on paying ourselves first, knowing that we're the only ones that are going to take care of ourselves. But more importantly, have a plan. You know, would you talk a little bit about some of the steps that the money instruction program goes through to help create financial literacy for individuals?
Yes, and thanks for asking. The Money Instruction Book is our 14-chapter personal finance course. And for listeners that are unfamiliar with it, we start out at the very basics. The first five chapters cover the basics, and the very first chapter is attitude. And it's titled, How to Monetize Your Attitude. And the reason that we focus on that is because, as you had made a comment earlier, so many people think that they don't have a right to accumulate any money and that they always ought to be in debt, and that's just going to be their lifestyle. And so we ask people to evaluate their attitude by asking certain questions about certain habits they might make and so forth. And having a positive attitude regarding your finances is critical to success. If you have an attitude, I'll never be able to save any money, I can't seem to get on top of my finances, guess what? You're absolutely right. You never will and you won't be able to. But on the other hand, if you have a positive attitude and you set down a written plan about how you're going to make changes in your personal finance, you can and will make a difference in your life. And it all begins with where you spend your money. Remember what I reported earlier to listeners? Everyday spending decisions, especially credit-based ones, do far more harm to your financial future than any investment decision you'll ever make. And so we focus on getting a good attitude and then how to spend what money you have properly, and we show you very clearly in the book how to make your priorities and determine what's important to you. And if getting out of debt is important, then you will commit every available dollar and extra penny you have to getting out of debt, and you will be making every spending decision with the idea of how can you spend less and save more and retire your debt. As part of the personal finance course, as we just talked about earlier, we talk about the big picture and the close-up picture in your finances, and that is measuring your net worth and your cash flow. And then when we get done with the basics, we show you how to set up and establish a spending plan and set some goals and how to reach those goals by pointing out how you take steps each day, for example, to reduce your debt and or increase your savings. We show you what steps to take and how you can work them into your personal financial life on a day-to-day basis. And then importantly, if you've got a family and children, it's critical to share those goals with your family and your children and start teaching them about money too.
I think that is critical for familial financial independence. I know that so many people get so caught up in their lives, and things are so hectic, and I've got to run this kid here and that kid there, and, you know, you've got, you know, divorced families that are trying to get by on half of what they had, and, you know, you've got frazzled moms and frazzled dads that are single parenting out there as a result of, you know, their personal choices, and the last thing that you need is to have a kid at the grocery store throwing extra things in the cart at the register, and, you know, just because they want it and they pitch a fit, and so you give in because you don't want to listen to them pout or scream or cry. And just a simple, comprehensive talk with your kids about money that's age appropriate, you know, before you go out and go shopping and say, let's talk about what our goals are, let's talk about what's going to happen when we're at the store, and we know that we're only there for food and we don't have time or resources to buy a bunch of toys or a bunch of gum or a bunch of stuff that's not good for us, and get their buy-in before they go to the store, and understand that, you know, when you opt for instant gratification today, you're borrowing your future for right now, for this moment. And while satisfying ourselves in this particular moment has value, we're the only ones that are responsible for ourselves in the future, and we have to be able to plan for that too and be systematic. And I think that that was one of the things that I liked about the money instruction program, was that it focused on involving and educating your children in the money world and the financial process, and specifically the family's financial plan. Because that makes all the difference, I think, if you have the whole family's buy-in.
Heather, that is so insightful. And, you know, you brought two things to mind. First one is that a shopping experience at the grocery store is usually a child's first exposure to money and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Second thing you brought to mind is a comment that our founder, Lauren Dutton, often made, and that was, is that you have an obligation to be as good to the person you're going to be in 20 or 30 years as you're treating yourself today. And so he always said that, you know, with retirement and financial planning in mind at the end. But he always wanted to remind people that, you know, you're going to, 20 and 30 years from now, you've got an obligation yourself to treat yourself good then as you are now, which means you need to have to plan a little bit. Back to the children and money for a second. This is a good opportunity for parents to teach their children and expose them to money in a variety of different ways, and grocery shopping is one of the best ways to do it. It gives you an opportunity to introduce young people to the grocery flyers that usually come in your mailbox every week or that you can get at the grocery store if you're in smaller communities. Second thing it does, it points out how you can take advantage and use coupons when grocery shopping and save some money. And third, it gives you an opportunity to sit down and plan. Now, at a grocery store, most people will take a list, and it's okay to add things to the list, just don't do it in the store. And so you're teaching your children planning principles. You're teaching them how to take advantage and look for sales. You're teaching them the advantage and power of couponing. And
yeah.
So all of those are great positive experiences. And as you said, Heather, when you see an ad come on TV, for example, and a furniture store is offering four rooms of furniture with no payments till 2012, there's an opportunity to ask your children what they think about that. How can that business person stay in business, sell you furniture, and not get any money for 4 years? And so these are the kinds of conversations to strike up with your children. And it says buy one, get one free. Well, now, is it really free, or are you paying a higher price to get that free? And these are the kinds of questions and conversations to engage your children in, and then you'll find them bringing those things up to you as they grow older.
Isn't that amazing, too, when they do that? I think that that's so powerful when you teach a concept and you're not sure if it's stuck, and then all of a sudden something that you shared with them, they're coming back around to you with, and you just get so excited and your heart just really just fills your whole body with enthusiasm that a concept actually cemented itself and they understood the concept and were able to apply it when they bring that information back.
Absolutely
now,
right. And the children have fun too. You give the children a coupon book, you give them the coupon flyers, and you give them the sale flyer from the grocery store and say, okay, let's go through and you find everything that you like that there's a coupon for that might be on sale.
Mm-hmm.
And so it gives the children an exercise. They're doing something, looking for something that they like and enjoy. And so it's a way to get them involved and keep them involved and show them how it benefits them.
I like the delayed gratification of, say, we can add anything to the list, not while we're in the store. So that really curtails any impulse spending that they could have. And it shows them how to think about something and, ooh, like it might be great right now, but like 10 minutes from now or 10 days from now it might not be so important. So if they think enough in advance and they remember to put it on the list later, then it must be something that they see some value in, and it helps short-circuit that whole instant gratification reinforcement by saying, oh, okay, well, just this time we'll throw it in the basket.
Yeah. And it also helps to demonstrate financial self-discipline on the part of mom and dad. And, as a parent, one of the things you dislike doing is watching your children make bad mistakes and waste money. But every now and again, that's required. And far better for them to make a spending decision that was bad when they're teenagers and we're only talking about $40 or $50 or $100, as opposed to making spending decisions that are bad when you're an adult and they're costing you $4,000 and $5,000. And so sometimes when we have a young person make a spending decision, let's say they went out and bought one of these new iPods or something like that, and paid $150 or $160 for it, and then the next week find they could have gotten it on sale or with a coupon for $99. Well, rather than grind them over that decision, we say, well, what do you think you could have done differently? Well, I could have waited. Yeah, that's one thing. And so those are the kinds of disciplines that we want to help our children develop. So if you're a parent, you know, and they want their money that they put in savings, let them take it and save it, because otherwise you're going to hear the complaint, well, you make me save money, but you don't let me spend it. And so that's a valid complaint. And so if you want to keep the children motivated, let them spend some of their hard-earned, hard-saved money sometimes and make a few mistakes, and then they will learn better how to shop comparatively and get a better value for their dollar. And that's what it's all about, is getting a better value for your dollar, not necessarily cutting back, but getting more for less.
What resources does the ICFE have for children's financial literacy and helping parents?
We have a couple of different resources in our bookstore and on our storefront. In addition, we have a website that is just packed full with ideas for parents, for grandparents. We have, for example, 10 ways to teach your children or grandchildren the value of money. We have an interactive spending quiz for young people. We have links to other websites, government websites, for example, MyMoney.com, which is part of the Financial Literacy Commission, having to do with the President's plan for improving financial literacy. Some of the resources that we have in the bookstore include one called Money Habitudes, which is a card game, believe it or not, and helps people figure out what their attitudes are towards money. This is more often used in a counselor setting, but we do have some parents that take and use that. We have a software program called Family Bank, which is a savings program for young people. And the Family Bank is that the parents set themselves up just like bankers. They write their children checks when they do a chore or something like that. The children take the checks and cash it, so they learn about banking and all those kinds of systems as well. And that's been a very popular program, and that's called Family Bank. And that's just a few of some of the many resources we have for young people to learn about the value of money.
Well, I'm so glad that you came on the show today. We're already out of time. What's the telephone number over there if people want to call you for more information?
Well, the most of our information, Heather, is on our website, as you know, and that's www.icfe.info. If people have a question they need to get answered or some sort of a consumer crisis type thing, they can reach the Institute at 619-239-1401. We're headquartered in San Diego, California, so remember, if you're on the East Coast, to account for the time change differences.
Great. Well, thanks again so much for joining our broadcast. And for those of you who are driving around right now and didn't get a chance to write down that website, as always, that information is available at www.unlockyourwealth.com. We'll be right back with more of Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio right after this.
Like, has your cell phone or iPod ever totally run out of battery before? Maybe you're somewhere without power, like fishing, camping, or the beach. Now you can have all the power you need. The K3 Charger by Kinesis Industries uses wind and sun to charge your devices anytime, day or night. Use the wind and sun to store up charging power, or charge your device right on the spot. Available now for $99.95 at www.kinesisindustries.com. That's Kinesis, K-I-N-E-S-I-S, industries.com. Like, go there, totally!
Hi, this is Melanie, and I'm part of Two for the Road USA. I'm the X from Boomer and X. I've been test driving cars for several years, but in the last 18 months, I found it difficult to get in and out of the test vehicles. I kept complaining the manufacturers didn't make the seats large enough until I realized it was me who was too large at 220 pounds. Thanks to the Diradori weight loss program, I lost 50 pounds. The Diradori program is physician-supervised, non-surgical, safe, and effective, and you can lose up to 5 to 10 pounds the first week and 15 to 20 in a month. I did. It controls hunger and trains your body to burn fat, all on an easy-to-follow regimen of exercise, hydration, and delicious, healthy eating. It is a three-phase program combining medication, nutrition, and exercise. This is an affordable program with counselors available at any time. I went from a size 20 to a size 10 in 7 months, and I feel like a different person. Check out my photos on twofortheroadusa.com. Click on Watch Melanie Lose Weight on Diradori. Call Diradori now at 480-661-9662.
Karen Gurm here. You probably recognize me as your segment host for News by the Numbers. Did you know I am also one of the certified NLP practitioners and a financial coach here at the Unlock Your Wealth Foundation? The most successful people in life have coaches to guide them along their chosen path. Tiger Woods, Michael Jordan, Tony Stewart, Tom Hopkins, Robert Kiyosaki all had coaches. Whether it was their father, someone else's father, or another person who helped them to shape their desires into an achievable path to success with a system of accountability where quitting was the only way to fail. Each of these people had someone who didn't see them as they first were, but as the person inside they knew they could easily become. Financial coaching can be the single addition you need to become financially independent. Call the Unlock Your Wealth Foundation now for your free consultation. 1-866-966-9420. 1-866-966-9420. Or visit us on the web at www.unlockyourwealth.com.
Even in today's economy, I, Count Dracula, have had to foreclose on my castle. But because of Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio, I have not only reacquired my castle, but I have opened a resort for the undead. Tune in to Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio. She's the only one not trying to suck you dry.
In life for free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money. That's what I want. Your love.
Yes, it's the moment you've been waiting for, the Millionaire Minutes. And our Millionaire Minute is where we crawl into the heads of top millionaire thinkers and put out 60 seconds of tools you can incorporate into your life right now, today. And this week's Millionaire Minute is brought to us by GenXFinance.com. And they say there are five ways to become a millionaire. And number one is to earn income. Clearly, the more money you make, the faster you can reach that milestone. But that doesn't mean your average Joe with the average income can't obtain millionaire status either. The current median income in this country ranges between $35,000 to $60,000, and depending on where you live. Better yet, get married, and then you have two incomes. The wonderful thing about having dual incomes is that even while two people are in the household, your income may double, but your expenses typically don't. Even if you don't earn an average income, it's not all lost. It's up to you to do something about it. A negative attitude about your job or earning potential won't change anything. Be proactive and make the decision to improve your situation. Number two, live within your means. Okay, so you have income, but now what? It doesn't matter how much money you make if you spend it all or spend even more than what you make. It might be nice to eat out at the nice restaurants every night or to always be on the cutting edge of designer fashion, but this will only make you feel like a millionaire, This doesn't mean you have to live a miserable and miserly lifestyle either, but you simply need to live reasonably. Start by purchasing a home that you can comfortably afford and drive vehicles that suit your lifestyle without straining your budget. You don't have to be pulling down $75,000 a year and drive a 1992 Civic hatchback or live in a dump, but throwing your money at a 4,000 square foot home in a gated community with luxury cars or SUVs that cost as much as 1 year of your salary won't help you become a millionaire. Some argue that the expensive home and real estate in general is a good way to become a millionaire, but let's focus on living within our means first. Number three, save money. This isn't rocket science, but if you earn a reasonable income and you live within your means, guess what? You'll probably have money left over to save. The problem most people have is that they put savings last as an afterthought. People say pay bills, buy things, and whatever's left over, they try to save. That's the wrong way to save. I'm sure you've heard it before, but pay yourself first, whether it's $100 a month or $1,000 a month. Think of the savings as a bill that needs to be paid and do it regularly. If you're unable to save money, you will find that your only wealth is in the form of material things. Number four, invest wisely. Now that you are saving money, you need to invest wisely. Sticking it under the mattress isn't going to help you reach your goals any faster. You don't have to read the Wall Street Journal or watch CNBC every day while actively managing your portfolio in order to be a good investor. Some of the best investment advice is simply to buy and hold and buy low and sell high. It's also important to remember that real estate is part of your investment picture, but it shouldn't be all of it. Too many people stake almost everything they have into a primary residence and expect it to appreciate in value. Just like any investment, generally speaking, over time you will make money. There isn't much debate about that, but relying heavily on real estate is no different than if you rely on one stock to fund your whole retirement. And number five, finally, if you have done the previous four items, the only thing left to do is to continue doing it and stick with the plan. As far as income is concerned, always be on the lookout for ways to increase your income, whether it is through climbing a ladder at your current job, finding work elsewhere, or maybe even starting a business on the side. Increased income means that you can save even more, provided you aren't foolishly spending the additional money. As the additional money gets tucked away into the savings and investments, it will continue to grow and even more quickly. It isn't hard if you work at it. Unfortunately, most people look for a way to get rich quick or to capitalize on the next big thing. It is true that some people have made their wealth through playing the real estate market, while others have done so by investing in a few stocks that exploded. But this is the exception and not the rule. If the above list seems overly simplistic, that's good. There are no secrets to becoming a millionaire, and almost anyone has the chance to make it happen. Now, fully and completely integrate these habits now. See yourself in this way. Look forward into the future and watch how differently people will respond to you, and imagine yourself with these successes already. Create some affirmations with these tools as well to reinforce what you've just integrated into your personality. And that's your Millionaire Minute. We've got so much more coming up, like guess what?
Yes, it's that time again, and our Unlock Your Wealth protege, Stephen Light, is here again with us to talk about his progress so far. Stephen, welcome to the broadcast.
Hey, Heather, what's up?
I'm just sitting in the broadcast chair trying to help some people create some financial independence. And so far, I'm doing a good job. Or am I? Tell me, am I doing a good job?
I think so.
Great.
I tend to be getting better and better at each show, so I think it's paying off.
Outstanding. Well, how did your meeting with the man go and on your break the budget?
It went okay. He yelled at me a little bit, but I promised him it wouldn't happen again, so I think it'll be all right.
Because you know what? The fact that he's yelling at you means I don't have to. How great is that? Yay, me!
this is true.
Well, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, go ahead. You're good. I was saying that this is true. That's a good thing.
Yeah, yeah. So less scolding for me, then I can just be, you know, I can be the good cop and praise you and tell you how wonderful you're doing, and then you're your own bad cop. So that's good. So I'm glad that we have that out. Now, this week's key is no seasonal exceptions. And we've come so far, if you think about it, from where we started. First, we had to admit we had issues with our finances, and we had to address the fact that maybe we've had our head in the sand, or maybe we just don't know about money. Maybe this is, we're just starting out. We haven't even had a chance to screw up yet. And but we need to learn about money. So we accepted our current position in life financially, but we knew that that wasn't our death sentence. And then we started to affirm our capabilities by using the power of affirmation, so we could create that belief inside of us that may or may not exist when we first start out managing our money, because when we don't know, there's a little bit of timidity. It's very easy to be shy. So then we took action, and we began our assessment phase. And that was so we could take an unbiased look at how we were spending our money. And then we got to do some of the good stuff. We had our visualization, and we created our dreams with deadlines. So we set some financial goals for ourselves 20 years out and then worked our way back. In Knowledge is Power, Not Knowing is Powerful, we identified all of the issues that we don't know about, but we should know about. We covered every area of our financial life that we should have some form of knowledge in. And if we don't, we're either going to, A, go out and get it, or we're going to delegate it to a professional if we don't have the time or ability or the resources to obtain all of that information, like taxes, things like that. Then we learned to take emotion out of the picture. And we learned how to be excited about the prospect of making money and chasing our professional dreams. But we wanted to be devoid of emotion when it came to making spending decisions, because we buy on emotion and we justify with facts later. Oh, well, it was on sale. Yeah, well, you know, it might have been 30% off, but if you wouldn't have spent the money to begin with, it would have been 100% back in your pocket. So we learned how to take emotion out of the financial decision-making in our lives, and then we went for hope for the best and plan for the worst, and we learned about the things that would keep us from our financial goals and how we have to have a plan B in place in order to anticipate life's little catastrophes and then make sure that we are protected against those things to ensure our financial success. Then we learned how to break the budget. And instead of the same old, like a diet you go on to and off of, we kicked the budget to the curb and we created a healthy savings and spending plan. We learned how to pay ourselves first and how we need to be focusing on working 1 hour a day for us, one eighth of our career goes to us, and then the rest can go to bills and whatever else we want to do. But this week's key is the killer key, because this is the one that the other parts kind of don't plan for. This is, yeah, I have a plan B, but I'm going to go out and be stupid anyway sometimes. No seasonal exceptions is just that. We are going to learn how to not to justify our bad behavior or say, oh, well, it's a birthday or Christmas or, you know, bar or bat mitzvah or whatever the occasion is, graduation, you name it. If you're not financially prepared to make a significant expenditure, you shouldn't be doing it. And we can justify our position using the rules of good manners and etiquette. That is what's so great about no seasonal exceptions. And most people, you know, it's not like we don't know when Christmas comes every year, but somehow it always catches us off guard and we always seem to spend more than we should on it. So given this key, Stephen, what do you typically do at the holidays when it comes to expenditures that you're making?
You mean as far as I'm spending?
Yes.
Yeah, I, holiday time, I tend to, I have cut back a lot, actually, in the last probably 2 years, but before that, I used to think of every person I know, whether it was family or friends or whatever, and didn't care what the price on stuff was. If I saw something I thought someone would really like, I'd just go out and get it for them. And I would probably have, you know, 20 to 25 people a year I'd buy things for. And in the last 2 years, I've really, really done good to cut back. And not that I don't want to do those things, because I love doing those things, but now it's like, you know, I don't have the money to do that. So I really got to just get the people that, you know, family, friends, the ones that we always see no matter what on Christmas, got to kind of stick with those kind of people and focus on that kind of Christmas. And it's not easy. It's definitely hard when you want to get everyone you know things and you can't, because, you know, you got to watch your money like everyone else is. And even my family's having to do that. They're not buying for as many people as they used to. They're sticking to more of the basics as far as family and friends goes.
Yeah, it's tough, you know, because, you know, you want to do as much as you can for the people that you care about and that are important to you. And sometimes we feel an obligation that just doesn't exist, and sometimes people lose sight of what the holiday is really about, and it's about the memories and the time that you spend with folks. And some of the things that we should be doing, we're not doing because we feel like if we don't make a cash expenditure, or for most people, it winds up being a credit expenditure. Again, we're borrowing the future to pay for the present. And then, you know, then in January, we have an emotional breakdown when we open the mailbox and those bank statements all come in. And, you know, the rules of etiquette say you don't, it's not a tit for tat thing. This isn't an eye for an eye when it comes to gift giving. And I think that that's where a lot of people go wrong. I champion you for already having a good attitude about this, and being able to address that, you know, maybe this isn't in my best interest. You know, have you thought of any kind of alternative that you could do for folks to still recognize them and make them feel valued during the holidays, but maybe not have to make a financial expenditure?
You know, the only thing I could really think of, short of just trying to find things less expensive as gifts, is, you know, certain people I found, you know, hey, I don't necessarily need to give them a gift. How about just a Christmas card? So that I'm still thinking about them, and that they still know that I care, and I know, you know, that we're still related to them or whatever. And other than that, you know, just trying to cut back on the things that I do buy and try to find things at a better rate and try to save money in any way. But Christmas cards is really the only other way of saving money without going overboard that I could think of. In the last year and a half, like I said, I haven't had a lot of time to figure it out, but that's what I figured out here in a short amount of time.
Yeah, and that's really powerful, too. So, Stephen, think about this. When it comes to seasonal exceptions, there's actually quite a number of things that you can be doing to be proactive and be remembered, and no one will feel slighted because of the way that you created an opportunity and saw this limited fund situation as a positive thing to be able to reconnect with folks in different ways. And let's talk about those for a minute.
Our key this week, no seasonal exceptions, dovetails nicely off of our take emotion out of the picture key. We worked so hard to get to this point. Think about how far we've come with our Keys to Riches, the Financial Freedom Series. And for those of you who are joining us for the first time, again, welcome to the broadcast. And the Keys to Riches is a baker's dozen of financial concepts that not only teach you how to think like the rich and be in control of your own money, but also gives you specific techniques to create or fix your credit, reduce debt, save and invest, building wealth through real estate, all while transforming our current financial habits into healthy money management skills. And we have made such great strides since we first started at the beginning of this season. You know, we identified that either we didn't have any financial knowledge or that we needed financial knowledge or that we've been in the real-life financial marketplaces and maybe haven't made the best financial decisions for ourselves and our families. And now we're kind of caught in a pickle and we need to do something about it. So whether you were starting out or starting over, you accepted the fact that you needed to make a change in your life financially. We then decided to take action and make assessment of our financial habits. And those have been influenced by so many different people. So we did an organic approach, and we didn't look at our receipts. We saved them diligently for almost 2 months as we worked through some of the other keys, building up our mindset to be prepared to start addressing our savings and spending habits. And then after we started our assessment, we went right into goal planning with our dreams with deadlines. And then we took and learned knowledge is power, not knowing is powerful, and identified our areas of weakness with regard to financial literacy and figured out how we can fill those gaps. Then we also took and we went and we took emotion out of the picture. And we learned how to make effective decision-making skills by not employing our emotions and dissociating our emotions that we have from our money-making ventures, because we want to be emotional and excited about that, but then we become emotionally engaged with that money. And then when we go into the spending portion of our lives, that's where the emotions take over and usually make an effective decision. So we've learned how to separate those two and keep our passions in perspective. We want to be excited about making money, but we want to be reserved about spending money. And then we hope for the best, plan for the worst, and we learned how to set up our multi-tiered plan to be prepared for financial catastrophe as we are slowly building wealth for ourselves and our families. We also learned how to ensure for our success. And then we learned how to break the budget and get out of that negative budgeting, sacrifice, starvation mentality, and worked to create a new healthy mentality where we put savings first and we created a healthy savings and spending plan. And we save first as opposed to last because we make it a priority. We pay ourselves first because we are worth it. Because if we don't take care of ourselves first, we truly will not be able to take care of others. And we're not martyrs. We're human beings. We deserve to be rewarded for our efforts. And now we took and created this amazing healthy savings and spending plan by assessing the envelope that we started in week two and moved our way up and created this healthy savings and spend, and as we went along and categorized all of our stuff from last week, all of our receipts, I didn't need to be the bad guy because you three having your meeting, me, myself, and I, were able to beat yourself up sufficiently enough, knowing what expenditures needed to go, knowing where we could cut back if necessary, and most importantly, how we could be creative when it comes to our savings and spending plan and not having to sacrifice like when you diet and you have to give up something. What we do is we learn how to be creative to keep the same benefits but maybe in a more cost-effective manner. And if we do have to relinquish some of our favorite things that financially are a little cost prohibitive for us, then we learn how we can still incorporate those. If we can't be creative, then what we do is we figure out a way to pace that and create it more of as a delayed gratification type of reward. Instead of saying, no, I'm not going to have any chocolate cake, no, I'm not going to have any chocolate cake like we do when we're on diets, and then all of a sudden we pass by the window and we see that beautiful chocolate cake and we buy the cake, and instead of just having a slice or part of a slice, we go nuts because we've sacrificed for so long. So what we want to do, instead of sacrificing and cutting out things, is pace them. So instead of going out to eat two or three times a week, maybe we go every 2 weeks and we pick somewhere special so that we can look forward to it. And then that way we get the satisfaction of having whatever that particular item is without having to give it up, but it doesn't financially distress us to the point that we can't function in our normal lives and we can't create savings where we always have to keep running to credits as our solution. So we've worked all through that. We've come so far. And then those silly things called holidays and birthdays, bar and bat mitzvahs, and those things that are so emotionally significant to our lives because the event is emotional, our decision-making gets clouded. Even though we learn how to stop the chemical dump that keeps us from responding effectively and we just react, because this is a significantly emotional event when it comes to holidays and special occasions, that we lose control. And here we are. We're having a chemical dump, and now our body is just reacting to the chemicals, and we're making ineffective decisions when it comes to our finances. And we can't make seasonal exceptions. We can't say, oh, well, this person got me a $100 gift. I need to get them a $100 gift, even if you don't have $100. Okay? And they're not the only person on your list. We can't do this long term and expect to be financially independent. It just won't work. And recognition of others is important, especially when it comes to special occasions and holidays and things where we have our families together and we're creating memories. But the key word is memories, okay? Now, I can't remember all the toys that I broke growing up as a kid when it came time for Christmas. But I do remember the people that were around and the things that were said and the good times and the food. I remember those things. I don't remember all of those toys. And so when we think about gift giving, it's not so much about the recipient. It's about us, especially if we're getting in a tit-for-tat competition. Giving is not about the recipient. It's about us as a giver. And so we're giving because it gives us a level of satisfaction to reward somebody, to recognize somebody, to acknowledge them with a gift. Some people give for the wrong reason. Some people give to create an indebtedness, like a you owe me kind of feeling. And so, again, whether our intent is to make someone else happy, we're making ourselves happy by doing that particular thing. It's the charity that we enjoy, the gift giving. That's our selfish satisfaction. And remember, the word selfish is not a bad word. It is not bad for us to be out for our own best interests. That's how we function as human beings. If we weren't out for our own best interests, it would be hard to convince us to be out for someone else's for very long. So we must be out for our own best interest. And there is a level of satisfaction we derive when we give somebody something. It's about us. I wanted you to have this particular item or thing. And as such, because gift giving is about the giver and not about the recipient, we have to remember when we are on the recipient side of things. In order to be a gracious giver, one must be a gracious recipient. You have to be able to receive because, again, the whole point is that it's about the giver. And if you are not a gracious recipient or you refuse a gift, then, number one, you're being rude, according to the rules of etiquette and proper comportment of oneself. But you are also stifling the karmic flow. Now, we can't jeopardize that karmic flow. Because if we feel like we're not getting in a certain area of our life, it's because we've got the giving and receiving flow interrupted. And if somebody's trying to give to you and you are not being a gracious recipient, then you're stopping that flow of karma in other areas of your life, because karma kind of just comes in and out, and it doesn't have a it doesn't go in the same door it went out. If you were charitable and gift-giving to someone else for something, you're not going to get it back necessarily in the same way. You may get it back in another area of your life, and that could be that much more significant for you. So here's where the problem lies when it comes to holidays, special occasions, and gift-giving. Because people don't understand why they're giving, or because they feel an obligation to give back identically, again, going in the same door it came out of, that because we don't want to spend $100, we don't want to accept a $100 gift from someone because we feel like, oh, well, then we're going to have to give a $100 gift back. Because we don't understand the whole gift giving, and because it's not just about the giving, but it's about the receiving. It's a twofold part to complete the karmic cycle of the charity. That what happens is that because we don't understand it and we have assumptions about how gift giving works, like we think, oh, well, it's tit for tat, an eye for an eye, if you do this and I'm going to have to do that, because we don't understand the gift giving process, or because we become selfless and martyrs and we overspend to try to impress others because we think in some way our debt's going to be repaid, that's where we lose control of our finances, because we have this confusion of understanding, first off. We have this assumption of how we're supposed to behave. And then we have all of the emotion attached to the special occasion or event that's going on. And we're totally clouded, and now our finances become impacted as a result. So what we need to do is kind of separate all of this out. And the rules of etiquette support us in our favor. I used to write an etiquette column, and gift giving was always something that people wanted to talk about. And I said, you know what? I'm not going to write that article from that point of view. I'm going to write that article about gift giving from the recipient's point of view. And it gave everybody a fundamentally new way to look at this whole gift giving extravaganza that goes on at holidays and special occasions and events. And you must put yourself first in every situation. What's important for you as an individual comes before what's important for your spouse and what's important for your children, because if you are not whole, then you will be unable to care for others. And if I'm describing you and you're saying, oh, but I could take care of other people just well, it's hollow. It's not a true level of satisfaction. You are not fulfilling your purpose, and your purpose is about you. And if you enrich the lives of others, that is your reward. So you're still, while helping others, you're helping yourself. So what we have to do is be clear, crystal clear, about how we proceed when it comes to seasonal holidays, events, special occasions, milestones in folks' lives. And I'm going to tell you how to do that right after this. We are going to a commercial break. You are listening to Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio. We have more in store just for you. Take a moment and we'll be right back.
Has your cell phone or iPod ever run out of battery before? Maybe you're somewhere without power, like fishing, camping, or the beach. Well, now you can have all the power you need. The K3 Charger by Kinesis Industries uses wind and sun to charge your devices anytime, day or night. Use the wind and sun to store up charging power, or charge your device right now on the spot. Available now for $99.95 at www.kinesisindustries.com. That's Kinesis, KinesisIndustries.com.
Hi, this is Melanie, and I'm part of Two for the Road USA. I'm the X from Boomer and X. I've been test driving cars for several years, but in the last 18 months, I found it difficult to get in and out of the test vehicles. I kept complaining the manufacturers didn't make the seats large enough until I realized it was me who was too large at 220 pounds. Thanks to the Duradori weight loss program, I lost 50 pounds. The Duradori program is physician-supervised, non-surgical, safe, and effective, and you can lose up to 5 to 10 pounds the first week and 15 to 20 in a month. I did. It controls hunger and trains your body to burn fat, all on an easy-to-follow regimen of exercise, hydration, and delicious, healthy eating. It is a three-phase program combining medication, nutrition, and exercise. This is an affordable program with counselors available at any time. I went from a size 20 to a size 10 in 7 months, and I feel like a different person. Check out my photos on twofortheroadusa.com. Click on Watch Melanie Lose Weight on Duradori. Call Duradori now at 480-661-9662.
Are you a referral partner of the Unlock Your Wealth radio program? Would you like to promote your products and your services on our show? Learn about the benefits that our featured advertisers receive being part of an exclusive program where the listeners are seeking financial independence and are in need of your insurance, finance, real estate, and investment services. Call now at 1-866-966-9420. 1-866-966-9420. Reach the people who need your help the most with the Unlock Your Wealth radio show today.
Karen Gurm here. You probably recognize me as your segment host for News by the Numbers. Did you know I'm also one of the certified NLP practitioners and a financial coach here at the Unlock Your Wealth Foundation? The most successful people in life have coaches to guide them along their chosen path. Tiger Woods, Michael Jordan, Tony Stewart, Tom Hopkins, Robert Kiyosaki all had coaches. Whether it was their father, someone else's father, or another person who helped them to shape their desires into an achievable path to success with a system of accountability where quitting was the only way to fail. Each of these people had someone who didn't see them as they first were, but as the person inside they knew they could easily become. Financial coaching can be the single addition you need to become financially independent. Call the Unlock Your Wealth Foundation now for your free consultation. 1-866-966-9420. 1-866-966-9420. Or visit us on the web at www.unlockyourwealth.com.
Hi, I'm Tony Stewart, driver of the number 14 Office Depot Old Spice Chevrolet, and you're listening to Heather Wagonaws on Unlock Your Wealth Radio.
Welcome back to the broadcast, everyone. You are listening to Heather Wagonhall's Unlock Your Wealth Radio. I am she, your hostess with the financial mostess, your maven of moolah, your savior of savings. I don't know. I'm crazy. We need to have a contest or something, I think, for some sort of tagline. I'm being featured in a book coming up, and they asked for a tagline, so I don't have one. If you have an idea or some clever shtick, some saying that you think is just perfect, why don't you submit it? That would be great. How about send me an email at taglines@unlockyourwealth.com, taglines@unlockyourwealth.com, and you too, like in the trivia question, can have your pick of all kinds of fabulous prizes if you're the one that we select. How's that sound? So yeah, taglines@unlockyourwealth.com. Why don't you send us your best tagline for me? So before the break, we were talking about No Seasonal Exceptions. We were having challenges with gift giving. So since we fundamentally did not understand, until we went over it during the first part, about gift giving, that it's about ourselves, us, not the recipient, and that when we give, we derive a level of satisfaction. And if we're giving for the right reasons, you know, by creating happiness of others creates happiness in ourselves. By acknowledging or recognizing someone shows them their value in your life. And that's an incredible feeling. And we touched on it lightly before the break, about being a gracious recipient. When we refuse gifts, for whatever our motivation is, we're stopping the flow of karma. And we can't afford to stop karma. Now, the rule is, whatever you do comes back to you tenfold. So if you do something bad, evil, improper, duplicitous, it's going to come back to you tenfold. But if you do good things for the sake of doing them, and here's the key, when you give, it must be for the sake of giving and for your own personal satisfaction, not because you are going to get. If we're giving to get, we're giving for the wrong reasons. And if you refuse a gift because you feel obligated to reciprocate in kind, you have to rethink your motivations when you give. But you must be a gracious recipient. It's not about, oh, if somebody gives me something, I'm going to have to do something back. No, 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 no. Because people are giving for the sake of giving, for their own satisfaction from being charitable. All they need is validation that their gift is well received. So how do you validate without going broke? Well, you can validate them for virtually next to nothing. I would say free, but like in my case, I'm traveling and I don't have stationery, so I'm having to borrow the hotel stationery. So, as we think about this, what can we do for free to recognize someone's kindness and charity toward us? Okay, you're thinking too hard about it. I'm going to give it to you in two words. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Even if you don't like it. Thank you. Even if you don't want it. Thank you. Even if it's extremely expensive and you could never possibly reciprocate in kind. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And that's it. That's it. Thank you. People want to see your gratitude. Be gracious and give it to them. People give for the satisfaction of the gift. They get so much value when they give you something and you smile and thank them graciously and profusely. That's what they want. They want to be recognized for their effort. They don't necessarily want something back. People who are giving for the right reasons only want to be recognized for the gift, for the charity, for the thoughtfulness. And if you're giving for the right reasons, that's what you want. You want a thank you. You want a smile. You want a hug. You want a, wow, that's great. Hey, everybody, look what blah, blah, blah just did for me. That's why you give, for the satisfaction of giving and being acknowledged for it. So as a recipient, we must acknowledge the giver, and we must accept the gift. Now, if it is a particularly expensive item, one that you could never afford to repay in kind, then you must be articulate in your thank you. Possibly it's more than just a verbal. Maybe you call them on the phone when you receive it in the mail. and say thank you very much, but follow up with a handwritten thank you on a note card, on a lovely piece of stationery that you can swipe from a hotel room if you can't afford your own. But recognize them in a concrete fashion, not just some crappy little email, thanks. No, you pick up the phone, let them hear your voice, let them hear your excitement and enthusiasm for the gift that they just gave, and then follow up with a handwritten thank you. That's all etiquette requires of us, is to be a gracious recipient. You don't have to blather on, oh my God, thank you so much, I could never repay you. Clearly, if you are in the employ of someone and they give you a gift and they have probably significantly more wealth than you, they are abundantly aware of the fact that you could probably never reciprocate in kind at the moment. That is not why they're giving that to you. They're giving it for the satisfaction of making you happy. They're giving it with the expectation of gratitude, of being a gracious recipient. I can't keep going over this more because the emphasis is so important on the gratitude. That's all you need for a gracious recipient. Now that we've gotten the gracious recipient portion out of the way, let's talk about the gift giving. All right. Christmas comes around on the same day every year. Your child was born and celebrates their birth on the same day every year. Graduations are usually known a year or more in advance, assuming that someone continues to pass grades. You kind of have an idea when someone's graduating from school. Special occasions, like the birth of a new family member. Special occasions like coming-of-age celebrations, quinceañeras, bar and bat mitzvahs, okay, other ethnic celebrations. They come with fair warning. So if you are a well-heeled personal finance aficionado, like you are as a listener of this radio show, and you are adhering closely to your savings and spending plan, you know not to make a seasonal exception. So what do you do? Well, since I know Christmas is 364 days away from the last Christmas, I know that I can start ferreting away a couple of dollars at a time to prepare for that event. I know that my daughter's going to have her quinceañera when she's 15. So I have 14 years to get ready for it. Is this starting to become crystal clear? Same thing with bar and bat mitzvahs. I think those happen around 13, if I'm not mistaken. Whatever your particular ethnic or religious celebrations are for coming of age, for baptisms, for holidays, for special events like graduation, Hall of Fame inductions, all sorts of stuff. You know well in advance when that's going to happen. And as a result, it makes it very easy for you to plan in advance. So we have a great worksheet, by the way. And I guess I shouldn't call them worksheets because that people don't like the word work. I guess it has a negative connotation, although I love to work. I'm always working. But we have a worksheet that, because I can't seem to think of what else to call it, an action plan, a holiday spending action plan, a holiday savings action plan. I'm not sure what it is. Anyway, we have this great worksheet available for you to help you start breaking down your holiday savings and systematically plan for special events and occasions. So, if you email us at hotsheet@unlockyourwealth.com, hotsheet@unlockyourwealth.com, we will send you a holiday savings and spending checklist. How's that? We'll call it a checklist. We'll send you this, the holiday savings and spending checklist, and it's a little planner that shows you how to step-by-step systematically figure out how you can manage a holiday without breaking the bank. And that is exactly what you need to do. So as we move forward, we have our key statement, key affirmation, and key action item for our nuts and bolts. So this week's nuts and bolts are, for our key statement, I know that I work hard and save my money and have created this fabulous budget. I'm sorry, our fabulous savings and spending plan. I broke the budget, that's what I meant to say. And as such, I cannot allow seasonal exceptions to derail me from my financial independence. Therefore, I must carefully plan and save for holidays, events, and special occasions. So our key affirmation item for this week is, I am fabulous at planning well in advance for holiday and special occasion spending. How fabulous is that? I love the word fabulous. I haven't put that in an affirmation in a while, so I thought I'd whip out that one for you. So we say our affirmations several times throughout the day. The first time we want to say it is in the evening before we go to bed. And we whip out our list of affirmations and we say them out loud to ourselves so we can get our subconscious mind focused on those items we want to bring into our lives. And we say them out loud, and as such, our subconscious minds can then create new neural pathways to bring these things into fruition for us in our lives. And then after we have a restful, restorative night's sleep, we wake up in the morning, and first thing we do, we don't roll over and kiss the spouse, we don't pat the dog on the head, we don't brush our teeth, no, we pull out our affirmation list, and then now focus our conscious mind specifically on our purpose, our tasks for the day, our true higher purpose, which is to bring these items into fruition for our lives, not just to, okay, I got to go feed the dog, I got to let the cat out, I've got to change the baby and get him ready to drop off at daycare and then go to work and then take little Susie to soccer practice and little Johnny to football practice. No. That is not the purpose of our day. The purpose of our day is to create fulfillment. And we do that through financial independence because that creates satisfaction and freedom. And we get satisfaction through freedom that financial independence brings. And so after we have focused our conscious mind on all of this fabulous good stuff, then any time we encounter negativity throughout the day, and sometimes that's more often than others, as of late for me, because what we think about, we bring about. So we want to focus our conscious mind on positive things. And if we've just had a negative interaction with a spouse, significant other, coworker, boss, subordinate, customer, client, child, parent, sibling, principal from the our kids' schools, whatever that negative occurrence is, we can't allow it to fester. That's how cancer takes hold. When we have all of this negative emotion rolling around through our body, so we're going to circumvent any chemical dump that is a reaction to our negative event. No, we are just going to respond by replacing that negative stimulus with positive thoughts. And we're going to refocus our positive mind on the things that we wish to bring into fruition. So some days you'll say your affirmations a whole lot. Some, not so much. But as long as you keep it in the forefront of your conscious mind, the repeated exposure will have it sink into your subconscious mind. And when we understand the why we are doing things, the how sorts itself out. We heard that from Larry Winget last week. When we have the why in place, the how sorts itself out. So that is our key statement and key affirmation item. Our key action item for this week is going to be a gracious recipient and to start planning, since we're only in February, our holiday expenditures for Christmas or Hanukkah or whatever your end of the year celebration may be. Right now, I have been enjoying Chinese New Year because it's the new year, and it is the year of the tiger. So let's make this your year of the tiger and approach your financial independence with ferocity. And as such, you are going to first send us an email requesting our checklist, and then you are going to work the checklist to create your own holiday savings and spending plan for those expenditures that come up all at once. We can systematically save throughout the year for those particular items, holidays, birthdays, you name it.
So, Stephen, hopefully that's given you some new ideas and a fresher perspective on some creative ways you can still recognize and remember people and show them their value in your life without you having to break the bank or go into debt to do that.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%, and definitely I'm going to try to bring that into my life when it comes time to do that. When time comes to think about that stuff and try to make everyone happy, that's definitely a way I'm going to have to think about it now.
Yeah, you know, and it doesn't hurt to plan ahead. It doesn't make you a bad person if you schedule your spending for things like that. And that's something that is so easy to do when you work it into your healthy savings and spending plan. It's not like we don't know what day Christmas falls on. It's not, you know, ooh, a chess game. I wonder what day it'll be this year. We always know when it is. So we know that we want to spend a certain amount of money for someone, and it's so much easier if we just set a couple of bucks aside systematically over time than it does to gouge ourselves when we're completely unprepared. So that's your homework assignment. And next week, we will check in with you and see if maybe the wheels have turned and you've come up with other ways that you could probably create a wonderful holiday or a celebration experience for someone without having to go into debt to do that. Good luck this week on the racetrack.
Thank you very much. Looking forward to it.
Outstanding. Well, we'll see you next week. Take care.
All right, you too.
Well, what an incredible show. I would like to thank my guests for Investor's Edge, Paul Richards, for joining us, and also our check-in from our Unlock Your Wealth protege, famous NASCAR race car driver, Stephen Light. And, oh, by the way, I wanted to tell you, last week I got up Sunday morning and was watching the Communist News Network because I was in a hotel, and so I didn't turn the TV on. I was just watching it. And I had to listen to the most ridiculous thing I had ever heard. And it made me so angry, and it caused such a foment that I blogged about it. So if you haven't been to the website this week, please surf on over www.unlockyourwealth.com and click on our blog. I said some interesting things about the state of the economy and our, quote, financial crisis. I feel like, personally, we're in a morality crisis. And so I shared some thoughts, and I thought maybe you might want to surf over and take a look. Maybe might provide some insight that you're not getting through mainstream media. They won't tell you the truth, or they commingle it in such a way that it flies over your head because you have no idea what they're talking about, like in a congressional filibuster, for example. So I try to sort some things out based on George Soros' comments on CNN. I think he's so out of touch with reality because I think that there's a point where you have so much money that you just become removed from how the world really operates because you play in such a different playground. So I just wanted to, again, thank all of my guests and make sure that you send us an email for a tagline, taglines@unlockyourwealth.com. I really need a nickname, folks. So if you can help me out, I'd be happy to reward you with some of our fabulous prizes from our prize vault for trivia questions. If you have the trivia question or you have the answer for the trivia question, since no one answered it on this show, please send us your answer or potential right answer to trivia@unlockyourwealth.com, trivia@unlockyourwealth.com, and maybe you too can be a trivia winner for fabulous prizes. And if you haven't subscribed to the eZine, please do so. It's eZine@unlockyourwealth.com, eZine@unlockyourwealth.com, for a weekly magazine delivered hot off the presses to your inbox for email. And you will receive tons of tips, tricks, news, tools, and information to help you and your family get on your way to financial independence. It's been so great this week chatting with you all. I'm so excited. We have an incredible broadcast coming up next week, and I believe we're at Create Credit, if I'm not mistaken. So pay attention, because Monday starts all these new credit card rules. We will talk about those on Wednesday's show. So thank you so much for tuning in. I'm Heather Wagenhall. You've been listening to Heather Wagenhall's Unlock Your Wealth radio show. Thanks so much for tuning in, and here's to your financial independence.
I've had it up to here, listening to a small segment of people trying to put down America. America's the greatest land on earth, and we ought to be proud of what we have. I'm proud of America. I'm proud of our people, and I'm going to prove it. We're American, and damn proud of it.
Frankly, I'm getting a little ticked off.
Go to hell.